Hey everyone, before we get into the show, just a heads up that this is episode 366. No matter what I say, Josh was an awesome interview, and I know we're going to have him back on again soon. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 365. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have on the show for the very first time. I feel like this is something we should have done a long time ago from all the times we've seen each other, like Perform Better summits and things like that. But damn, Josh Hankin, it's great to have you on the show finally.
I really appreciate it, Kevin. You know, like you said, it's been long overdue, but I super appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I know you guys, 365, that's pretty impressive there, my man.
Yeah, well, you do one every week, and if you just do it long enough, it eventually adds up to a big number. So
that's how I said I got married to my wife. I took off, she just ended up thinking that she needed to be with me.
No, that's how it works. And I mean, people have known you if you've been to like the Perform Better summits, if you've been around in the industry, you know, Ultimate Sandbag and what Josh has been doing with that, and really just helped elevate the level of education when it comes to sandbag training for people out there. It's a great tool. And as I mentioned on the show in the past, like, you know, I try to help promote stuff that I believe in. And we've had sandbags at MBSC. I mean, I think you came out like four, maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's been a while. I may have had some hair then even.
Oh God. Like it was so long ago. And, yeah. And you know, ever since then we've used, you know, sandbags at our gym. I think we have like 7 or 8 or something like that. And you know, we use them a lot with our adults, and, it's just an outstanding tool to have in the gym. And it's just like, it's an inexpensive tool to get there, because it's really like you get the bag. And I was surprised. I'm like, I had no idea. I was thinking, man, I'm going to go down to Home Depot. How much is sand? Like, what is sand? It's like $3 for 50 pounds or whatever it was.
It's a lot cheaper than shipping it.
A hell of a lot cheaper than shipping it. And so I was like, man, what does sand cost? Is it going to be like $20 to fill these bags? Like $50? Right. I had no idea, because the last time we bought sand was when I had a sandbox when I was 6 years old.
Sure.
But again, a really great setup for everyone out there. So what, you know, we're going to do is, you know, for guests that I've had on for the first time in the past, is like do a little bit of an intro. Like, I have questions for Josh, and I'm sure we're going to get into, you know, a bunch of different territories. We'll see where things go. And, you know, after that, you know, we'll wait a couple months. The audience is going to be up to you. If you have any more questions for Josh, you know, come back at us with them, and we'll get back on and we'll do another show and make sure we can answer all that stuff. But I think it's good to start at the beginning, because, I mean, what have you've been doing this for about like 10 years now. It was like 05 that you started this up.
That's right. Yeah.
So what, I mean, if you don't mind me with this like introductory question, like what was like, all right, yeah. Like when did you get introduced to sandbags, and like then think, all right, we have a better way that we can do this stuff?
You know, that's, I think, the most common question now, because people look at it sort of like, you know, the little things at the end of your shoelaces. You know, people are like, how come I didn't think of that? And really, it's just a journey of just sort of self-exploration and solving my own problem. I actually suffered from a herniated disc since I was 14 years old, playing basketball. And so I re-injured myself playing basketball in college at Arizona State. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're in college, you may know this all too well, you're unceremoniously retired when you're no longer of much use. So even though I wasn't playing basketball anymore, I was still in a lot of pain. Unfortunately, I had the self-realization that I wasn't going to be a professional athlete. So I was into the strength conditioning industry. And, you know, from a very early time, even in college, I was, you know, trying to go to, you know, continuing education programs, because I realized there was a gap between what we were being taught in school and what was happening in the industry. So very early on, I was very fortunate to be introduced to people that led me down the road to finding better and better people. And so really the sandbag stuff really came about 2002, when a colleague of mine told me to check out this up and coming kettlebell thing. And I'm like, I went online, like probably a lot of people I looked at, and said, I don't know, this kind of looks like what you can do with a dumbbell. And, you know, he pushed me to like, no, check out this RKC thing. It's really different. Just check it out. So in 2003, you know, I went to the RKC, and, I almost fell in love right from the get-go, not necessarily with the kettlebell per se, but with Pavel Ledoff, this RKC with, which was that there was a program about movement and the Kelbo was their way of expressing their philosophy of movement.
Right.
And having interned at strength conditioning facilities, you know, at the university level and, you know, doing some other programs, like I've never heard anyone express training in that way. Mm-hmm. And that was probably when functional training was starting to really come about strongly. I know it started in the late 90s, but like it was starting to really gain some steam and the, you know, the idea of training movement, not muscles was there, but mm-hmm. no one really knew what it meant. You know, it was sort of like, okay, kind of, sort of. And so after going through the RKC, I asked Pavel, like, I like to be a student, an internal student. And I asked him, I go, where did you learn about this stuff? Where did you learn how this philosophy? And he said, you know, read the old time stuff. And I'm like, oh, the stuff from like the 80s. And he's like, no, like the late 1800s and early 1900s. And mm-hmm. so thanks to the internet, you can actually do that nowadays. And so, you know, I go ahead and read a bunch of books by, you know, different old time strength athletes. And, you know, I think the thing that people miss about like what intrigues us about these old time strength athletes, because, you know, I heard a sportscaster say, like, we like to get nostalgic the older things get. Mm-hmm. Like things were always better back in the day. And that's not necessarily the case. So I think what we're enamored by is the fact they had such great movement skills, but they were so freaking strong too.
Right.
And it's like, what were they doing? And the big part that I think people miss out on is that, you know, they didn't have the internet. So it wasn't like Arthur Saxon was posting his WAD to Eugene Sandow at the time, you know? There wasn't a lot of communication between a lot of them. And even when they did, they were probably trying to keep their secrets to themselves, you know? It wasn't like they were open to sharing each other's secrets. Not like Peyton Manning went to help out Brock Osweiler out this weekend, right? You know, they wanted to keep their secrets to themselves. And so, you know, the one thing I found them all consistently talking about was odd object training. And I was really intrigued by that. And, you know, they also all had a history. I mean, in that day and time, you had a history of manual labor coming up from the farm. Like, you know, you weren't from it such an industrial time. So the combination of realizing they had built up, you know, this tolerance and this ligament and tendon strength from, you know, manual labor to this love of odd objects. And they all said for like a similar reason. They didn't have the science back then, but they understood why it worked. They understood, like, if we put in today's terms, they would do it for things like core strength, stabilizer strength, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so being a former athlete, all I have to hear is like, hey, this thing's the hardest thing, and I want to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like consistently they all said like this, a bag of something was the most challenging thing you could lift. And like, I'm sold. I want to try this thing. So basically I started off with an army duffel bag in my garage, probably made it about 80 pounds with the garbage bags and duct tape. And, man, it kicked my ass the first time. And so, I'm sitting there pouring sweat. I'm like, this thing that's freaking 80 pounds, like 80 pounds is something I'm used to holding in one hand, right? Like, why is this thing killing me? So what I did, what any good coach would do at the time, is I started applying it to all my clients, right? If it sucks for me, it's going to be 10 times worse for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had the same response. And so for a while we were using the bags, and I'll be the first to say that we were using them in the same nature as a barbell. I mean, that's what I knew and that's what we did. And then it came to a point where I'm like, man, it's, how do you progress people in this? And so I started trying to find everything I could about sandbag training. And, you know, it's funny now in retrospect, you know, Arthur Dreschel's book on Olympic weightlifting is 576 pages. Like, that's not on barbell training. That's on Olympic weightlifting, on two lifts,
mm-hmm.
right? It's 576 pages. The most extensive resource I could find on sandbag training was 48.
Hmm.
So what I started thinking about was, like, we've never really had a way of implementing this. And it's kind of a funny thing, Kevin, because what I started thinking about is, a couple things have to happen here because our clients were starting to plateau. I wasn't sure what to do with them because you can't micro load a sandbag.
Right.
I was like, well, maybe there's a reason this thing has never been a staple in, you know, training programs. Maybe there's a reason that, you know, coaches have never taken this thing really seriously, because if you ask most coaches, have they heard of a sandbag? They'll tell you yes. A lot of them will even say they've used them, and they'll say, and if you ask them if they're good, they'll say yes. But if you ask them, is it a staple of their program? They'll usually give you, you know, kind of like shrug it off type of thing. So, you know, I sat there and I'm like, well, either sandbags don't really work, either the way we use them doesn't work, or the actual implement itself doesn't work as well as we have it designed right now.
Right.
And so I like to believe that worked because there was something about it that just struck me. Like, we all know it's different picking up a 100-pound sandbag than it is a 100-pound anything else. So I'm like, okay, maybe it's just the way we're thinking about it. And the more I thought about what makes a sandbag unique, I started realizing probably the big thing that people don't understand about the sandbag, which is it has its own principles because it has its own unique attributes. And so we started developing a philosophy around it, trying to maximize what it does well and what it does better than anything else. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a big believer in that you should use the right tool. And that the tools are very different. You know, we've all heard the expression a tool is just a tool. I agree with that to an extent because it's really about the craftsman, right? Not the tool. But ultimately, a hammer and a saw are both tools and they're used distinctly differently. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, fitness is one of those interesting industries that tries to devalue our tools. And I don't really understand why. Like, imagine if you're a surgeon or you're in surgery and you heard your surgeon go, give me a scalpel or a clamp. It doesn't really matter. Like, you'd freak out. Mm-hmm. Or even if you're doing home, you know, you're doing home expansion and you hear your contractor go, give me a hammer or a screwdriver. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. Like, you'd freak out. But somehow in fitness, it doesn't matter. Give me a kettlebell, barbell, sandbag. It doesn't matter. I can't tell you how many times, and I'm sure you have too, I've heard people say that. So, you know, we really try to set forth a philosophy, and that's why we don't call it sandbag training. We call it dynamic variable resistance training, a system of looking at functional training in a different way and how this tool does it so well. Mm-hmm. So that was the short version of that question, answer to that question.
Yeah, and I think that's – unfortunately, that's something that we see across the industry because there's – people kind of get set in their ways. They want to do the same thing that they've been doing for a long time. They say, it works. Why would I change it? And things like that. Right. And that's an unfortunate thing with the openness of the industry where anyone can really be a, you know, personal trainer if you just jump on the internet and take a course for 2 hours. And, you know, just from speaking for myself, like I've been using the bags for a couple of weeks and now I have an 80-pound bag and the other bag I think is at like 35 or 40 pounds. And I'm almost 30, so I'm getting older and, you know, I don't.
You're making me feel old, Kevin.
I know. I'm sorry. I know. I'm sorry. But like, I'm getting a little bit older and also like at the same time, I'm getting busier and I just want to get as much bang for my buck when it comes to, you know, my training. And now I literally, I mentioned this the last couple of shows, but I train exclusively at my house now. I haven't trained at MBSC, which is, you know, arguably Men's Health says is the number one gym in America, but like, you know, they have all these awesome stuff. Like they have squat racks, they have, you know, dumbbells up to 120. But, the thing with like the sandbags is like, I can kind of almost also replace some of one thing that I hate a lot, which is conditioning, like straight up conditioning, like jumping on an Airdyne. I hate that. The only thing I really like out of conditioning is, you know, pushing a heavy sled. Like I really like pushing a heavy sled, but you know, I mean, I've used the bags at MBSC over the years with myself and with my clients and stuff like that. But, you know, when I started like actually kind of playing around with the stuff that like you include in the book, I'm like, holy crap. I just spent like 60 seconds and my heart rate has been jacked up. Like I did two lines of coke. Like this is something that is, it's one of those things where it is a little bit more eye opening, I guess, when you kind of focus on it a little bit more seriously. And you start kind of playing around with all the lifts that you have in there because like at our gym, we use it a lot for, helping improve people's squatting patterns, doing things like heavy carries, and things like that. But literally like if you have like, you know, use something that's appropriate in terms of weight, but doing like a reverse, like basically what's kind of almost like a goblet position or a front loaded, reverse lunge to an overhead press, and doing, you know, 5 reps on each side, like 10 overhead presses, 5 reverse lunges on each side for a set with that 80-pound, I was like gasping, like, oh, thank God, I don't need that Airdyne anymore. I can just jack my heart rate up with these. And, you know, at the same time, it's working out smarter instead of harder. Like,
right.
At this point in my life, like, I don't need to. And this is maybe we can get into the first part of the thing that I want to talk to you, which is like, it is home gym training, because that is something that I've gotten a ton of feedback on in the last couple of months. Now that I've been doing a lot more stuff in my house, like people asking, hey, what do you have for equipment? Like, what does your programming look like? Like, what have your results been? And I'm dead serious. I've put on more muscle mass. I've gotten stronger in the last, you know, 6-7 weeks that I've been training at home than I have at the gym. And I'm not saying it's because, like, you know, equipment's different or anything like that. It's saying that you can get strong at home by having a couple bags, a couple kettlebells, And like, I have two weight vests, like that's all I really have. And I've been able to have great results and at the same time work out smarter instead of harder. Like I don't need a deadlift 500 pounds. I feel better than I ever have, you know, mobility wise, and haven't had any injuries pop up. I feel great. And at the same time, just getting, you know, great training in. And I think it does mean a lot for some people to not have to go into the gym. If you have that stuff right there in your living room, you kind of have fewer excuses to say, I don't have the time to do it, when you could spend 30 minutes knocking out like some kettlebell and like sandbag circuits and stuff like that and get some great results out of it.
Well, I think that's a great point, Kevin. I mean, I think it's a couple of things here. I mean, you say something simple that's actually pretty insightful, because, you know, if you look at the history of how, you know, strength training started, like, strength training was not a very popular thing for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, for example, Olympic weightlifting started off, it was mostly done in competitive weightlifters, basically basements.
Right.
So I think the idea, I think people usually have the tendency to think of a home gym means lesser than.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've seen sort of by the nature of functional training that, you know, the same tools we're seeing in the gym are the same ones we can have at home. And what the difference is going to be the level of usage there, as far as like the quality of coaching, the quality of programming and techniques type stuff. I mean, it doesn't devalue the idea of going to a gym. Mm-hmm. It just means that we use these tools better. It sort of reminds me too of like the first time you ever go into a Starbucks and like there's so many options and you're just like, I just want coffee. You know, and I think that's how a lot of people feel about a gym. Like they want to get fit, they want to get stronger. They walk in a gym, there's 5 million things to use and play with.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up just sort of doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And so I think what happens by training at home, like you just said, you become more focused. And, you know, the other thing about it is I remember when kettlebell started. So I'm going to talk like the old fart, like, you know, back in my day, you know, kettlebells came in three sizes, 16, 24, and 32s. And in some ways I miss those days because I think the programming was more creative and thoughtful than just let's go heavier and let's just increase the volume.
Mm-hmm.
You had to, how are you going to make that next jump in weight? How are you going to make, you know, old time strongman had a great saying. They said, how are we going to make a lightweight feel heavy?
Right.
And I think there's a lot, you know, brilliance to that statement, because you have to start thinking about a lot more of the variables of training than just improving the load or the volume.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what happens to a lot of people when you get them, you know, these pieces of actually thinking about using them.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to start thinking about, like you said, like using them in the way they were designed and developed and intended, instead of trying to, you know, fit a square peg in a round hole, you know, and make everything based around the barbell. You use the implement for what it does really well. And all of a sudden you're like, holy crap, I got so much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And it just because I think people start focusing on a more broad spectrum of variables than just the load and the volume. And that's something I think people notice a lot. And then, you know, it's always funny too, you know, people will be like, you know, I'll ask them, you know, do you think people from the farm are really strong? You know, this old, you know, nostalgia that we have that farmers are really strong. And there's a lot of truth to it, right? One of my best friends grew up on a farm in Wyoming and he's fucking strong as hell. And, you know, people say, yeah. And they do just a lot of manual labor stuff. They don't do a lot of 1RM stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's the building of volume over time. And, you know, I bring that up because I go, well, do you think sandbags and kettlebells can get you really strong? They're like, well, they get you strong, but not as strong. There's always a but, right? And I'm like, no, they can, because of what we just talked about. That this idea of, you know, building volume over time is actually more productive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think way too many people have started jumping into the maximal load concept without realizing that even, you know, I have a friend who was a national level Olympic weightlifter that he was trained by a Cuban coach that studied in the Russian system. And then about, I would say 90% of their training is in about 70 to 80% of their max.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put in that perspective, these implements work in that same regards for most people. You know, so it's like most people, like they get strong and they don't realize how strong they're getting until they actually test themselves on something. And then they realize, like you said, like I always give the example, I go, whose back feels awesome after a maximal deadlift?
Right.
And they're like, well, yeah, but... Well, you know, that says something. I'm not saying maximal deadlifts are always bad, but, you know, I just recently got the wonderful opportunity to talk to Greg Cook, and, you know, we were talking about strength coaches, and you can always identify a strength coach, we said, by three things. They usually are bald, have facial hair, and they waddle. They don't walk. You know, and there's a lot of truth to that. So, like, we're sometimes also, my point in saying that is we're emulating the wrong people. Like, I think I respect the hell out of power lifters.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they do is amazing. But does your client and do you have a goal of looking and functioning like they do?
Right. Right. And you know, like that's, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people have talked about this in the past, and it's just a case of, you know, maybe your client shouldn't necessarily train the way that you want to train. Like right. if you want to go in and you want to go, you know, deadlift, you know, 600 for a triple, and then, you know, you may or may not pay for it the next day. Like that's totally fine. But, you know, for most of us, we're dealing with general population, or we're working with, you know, athletes that are going to, like, they live or die based on injuries. Like if we injure one of our athletes, like we're screwed. Like it is an incredibly big deal. And it's something that is a huge black mark on, you know, what we are as a, you know, organization or our coach or whatever. So that's why I think it's just been a great kind of evolution over these last 10 years where we've been able to, like you said, you can kind of make your training more effective, more difficult, whatever word that you want to make or use for it. But at the same time, you can not make the loads super, super, super heavy. And, you know, as those loads go up, you know, so does the, you know, risk reward ratio kind of that gets out of your favor a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, and I think people misunderstand load. I think that's like, you know, we talk a lot in our DVRT system about, you know, people forget that the fundamental concept of strength is progressive overload, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I go, what does that mean? And inherently, someone goes, well, you got to make stuff heavier. Well, yeah, but they don't understand the term doesn't necessarily mean only that. It means providing a stress greater than the body had before. Mm-hmm. And so when you start, I mean, people intuitively do some of this stuff, but they don't necessarily program it. So what are those other things? Well, if you alter speed, if you alter range of motion, if you alter volume, if you, alter density, if you alter, you know, plane of motion or load position or body position, or, you know, all these things influence intensity. So if you only focus on the load concept, you're ignoring about 9 other variables that affect intensity. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's where we try to get people thinking from a programming aspect, that you can ignore these other concepts, but they're what keeping you from making progress or staying healthy, because you may greatly increase the intensity without knowing it because you've altered load position or body position or plane of motion, or, you know, you haven't done those things progressively as you would weight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always chuckle too at the fact that there's only one implement that actually changes its load incrementally, and that's obviously the barbell. But yet we base everything off that one implement.
Right.
And every other tool you have more of. You have more dumbbells. You have more medicine balls. You have more kettlebells. Hopefully you have more ultimate sandbags. You know, but the point is that it's the only tool that microloads, and then we try to microload everything. That doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, if I said, hey, you know, if I took you to another industry, I said, hey, we have 10 different tools that we use. One does this thing, 9 do this. Would you base everything off the 9 or the 1? Exactly. You know?
Yeah.
And for some reason, we've chosen to base everything off the 1, not the 9. And so I think our programming has actually taken a hit, because people have started to ignore these other concepts in their programming because they focus on the micro loading or the small phase and volume.
And, you know, I kind of wrote this down just in terms of like, whether you're working with a general population or, you know, I don't want to single out, you know, female population, but, you know, sometimes having something like a kettlebell or a sandbag or something like that, where they don't think like they're moving a lot of weight around or something like that, you can kind of trick them into working a lot harder. At the same time, they're like, oh, well, I never want to go over like 30 pounds or something like that. Like, or I never want to go over 25 pounds. You can kind of give them, oh yeah, just here's this bag and do this thing. And not necessarily, you can like, not saying that you're going to trick them, but sometimes you kind of need to do that. And I wanted to talk to you about your trips out to Japan and stuff like that, because that's one of the things that with all my trips out there and the discussions that I've had with coaches and trainers and gym organizations out there is that, you know, for some populations, Japan population being one of them, like they love kind of like training with, I guess, light load or using body weight stuff, because the population out there doesn't want a big and bulky look. Like that's not the look people want to go for. They want to look for lean and thin and things like that. So you can kind of use these tools to do that. I don't know if you've kind of seen that as like, you know, in terms of why sandbags have become so popular out in Japan as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny to say, you know, women, I totally agree with you. I mean, obviously there's a lot of women that, you know, let's face it. I mean, even with the recent movement of encouraging, you know, women by women coaches to lift heavier, mm-hmm. it's still sort of a negative feeling by, I think, a lot of women. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you can't, you know, I don't think of it as necessarily like you were saying, you know, it's not tricking them. It's giving them what they need in a way that they'll sort of digest.
Right.
It's funny on the opposing side, guys, they don't like getting buried by 80 or 100 pounds when they can go lift 400 pounds, exactly. Right? Like, it's not cool to post on Facebook, I just got pounded by 80 pounds. Like, people look at you kind of funny, like, really? Like, dude, what's happening? But, yeah, you know, in Japan, it was really interesting when we – it was really nice. Kari and Travis brought us over. I know you know them real well. And the big thing they were telling us, like, you know, it's not like the U.S. Like, people don't like lifting heavy. It's just a cultural difference. And, you know, I think it's, again, one of those things where if you teach people the system and getting them to understand what functional training really means, then you can blame. Because, you know, I got the wonderful chance to teach in Russia. I taught kettlebells, ironically, in Ultimate Sandbags in Russia. And, you know, one gentleman raises his hand and goes, is this functional training or is this strength training? And I thought that was really interesting that they're perceived as different things. You know, and I said, well, it's obviously the same thing. But I think there is that. I think even in the U.S. and you know, Japan's a good example. Like, functional training in Japan was doing very movement-oriented stuff with very light loads, like you were saying, very, you know, bodyweight-esque. And, you know, as Kari and Travis said, you know, sort of sometimes circus-like. And I think that happens here, too. And that's functional. And then you have your strength training, which is the heavy barbell work, you know. As though they were different types of training methodologies. And I always say, no, the biggest thing with the problem with functional training is if I ask people to define what functional training is, they'll give me a philosophy. If I ask you to give me, you know, what is, let's say, Olympic lifting or sprint training, you'll give me methodologies. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do with our system is to define what functional training is. And when you do that, then all of a sudden you can bridge that gap from both aspects. You know, we have, you know, we're going back for our third time in Japan. And the reason I think it's been so receptive is, of course, the great work Kari Travis had done to build up the education awareness out there, but also people understanding and becoming more familiar with that they can have both sides of the spectrum, and they're not giving up either one, and they don't have to give up what they love to do and what makes them feel good, because you do also have to take into account what people perceive as good and what they understand as good and what they need, right? So, like, giving, you know, a kid a little bit of their vegetables, you have to give them a little bit of dessert so they'll eat their vegetables so that, you know, they can have what they want and need. Mm-hmm. So the same thing here. I mean, we'll give them, and they may focus on specific drills that sort of speak to them. Something that we say a lot in DVRT is you don't have to do every drill. You have to do the right drill. Mm-hmm. And that could be from a philosophical standpoint. It could be from a needs analysis standpoint. It could be from an emotional standpoint. But once people understand what they're capable of, I think they start doing more and more.
So, you know, another thing that I wanted to hit on is, you know, if you're comfortable talking about it, I mean, you're in the hospital a couple of weeks ago getting some surgery. What happened, man?
Yeah, seriously. My wife beats me like no one's business. No, that's what happens when you work together. No, finally that disc that, you know, I hurt when I was 14 years old. Now that, you know, Kevin reminds me I'm significantly older than him. You know, 25 years, you know, that the discs don't go back into place. Right. So the disc finally just went kaput. And, it was funny. I was just finishing speaking at Perform Bear at Long Beach. And, my leg was really hurting. I actually thought I like had strained like a hamstring or something. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily my back. My leg just getting worse and worse. And I said to Chris Poirier, I'm like, hey, I'm going to go ahead home early. I just want to make sure things are okay. He was okay with it. And, you know, I get home and God bless my wife. My wife's a physical therapist. She's working in the hospital setting. She has a golden rule. We don't go to the emergency room unless it's 10 out of 10. And, I've been educated that like pregnancy is 8 out of 10. So I don't know if I really know what 10 out of 10 is. but I finally convinced her that we need to go to the emergency room. Like my leg was killing me. And so we went in and did an MRI and they said, oh, the disc is really bad. And so they immediately admitted me for surgery. And so they were going to do it first as just a simple microdiscectomy, which is basically like cleaning up the disc. So it takes pressure off the nerves and the spinal cord. So they did that the first time and they said, well, you know, only 4% of people don't take to that. Well, guess who's super special? So I went home for a couple of days, didn't feel right, went back in, and they're like, well, we can do another one, or, you know, we can do a fusion. They did another one, didn't work, so we end up with an anterior fusion, which is really interesting when they go from the front, because they actually have to – it's actually better, but they have to move your guts. Yeah, which just feels like someone messed it with you from the inside. Now, interestingly enough, of course, people will assume like, well, if you're training so good, why did you have to go in for back surgery? You know, I have this sort of response – to that is like when they did the first microdiscectomy, they actually opened me up, the neurosurgeon said they weren't expecting to find what they found, and which is that the disc literally crumbled. which is code for not very good. And that literally he never saw a disc crumble like that. So it had been bad for so long. And I really sort of, instead of looking at like, why did my training not prevent this? As my training let me do this for that many years. Like I was a competitive Olympic weightlifter. Mm-hmm. I did competitive strongman. Like those are things I shouldn't have been able to do.
Right.
And so, you know, it depends which, you know, half empty, half full you look at. Like I'm looking at it as half full. Like I was able to do those things for that long because of what I'm doing and because of the system we've begun. And I've been able to rehab myself. My rehab's been all exclusively what we do in our system. And I've progressed from being able to literally not use my right leg to doing, you know, lunges and step ups and a lot of single leg work and, you know, walk my dog 7 miles a day because darn puppy's so active. But, you know, I think that's a testament to the system, not a detriment. And so I think every injury, I think as coaches, we all experience, hopefully we turn into good learning experiences. And, you know, I can't rewind to 14 years old, but I can only move forward from where we've been. And so I think it's really just opened our eyes to more and more things and been more interesting to see how the body really functions and really tailored into the nervous system, the power of that nervous system.
Mm-hmm. One of the best learning experiences is for, you know, you as a coach to get hurt.
Absolutely. It really opens your eyes to so many things and it makes you very relatable to people as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of clients think like, we've never gone through things or challenges or we're these like superhumans that love to chew on broccoli at night. And, mm-hmm. you know, our life is in the gym. And for some of us it is, but I mean, I think, you know, making us more human to people makes us a lot more, you know, relatable and people that can coach better because we're talking from a place that we can have people understand that we can appreciate the challenges that they're facing. Cause most of the people we're going to deal with have had some type of injury, right? Mm-hmm. Is this a statistical issue thing?
Yeah, that's a very fascinating thing because, you know, if you want to become a great bodybuilder, you should probably go to, you know, someone who is a great bodybuilder and see what they did. And I think with, again, just dealing with like the general population, maybe even the people listening to this show, like, you know, if you go get a Mr. Olympia to train you and write your programming, you may not get the best result because sometimes they're just genetic freaks. And the same times with like really, you know, there's coaches in this industry that are physical specimens. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like you said, they may not be able to necessarily relate to everything that you're going through as a person, no matter how many books they read about it. And if you can kind of relate to them, you can make that great connection. I know what you mean. Like, yeah, this morning I woke up and I needed to have pancakes. Like I know what you're saying. Like, I understand that feeling, that thing in the back of your head that's kind of like driving you nuts. But this is how you can deal with it. And same thing when it comes to training and things like that. So,
yeah, it's interesting. We have all had clients with bad backs, right? And, you know, going through this process with my back has actually made my clients trust me even more because they, I think before, obviously, they knew I had a history of back issues, but, you know, they think we're indestructible beings, right? When they see us do our stuff and, you know, we wouldn't do the crazy stuff. And, you know, to go through that process, I think, you know, and to see me come back from it, I think builds a lot of trust and faith in that, like, we do have their best interests at heart. And, you know, it's funny too. I had a friend years ago, he was training a lot of professional athletes, and you know this working from Coach Boyle's facility. Most athletes, as they get older, they don't get better. Right. You know, I heard a sportscaster once say, you know, there's only two things undefeated in sports. That's father time and women, right? And so, you know, father time always wins. Like, and he would have these professional football players and basketball players come in, and they were generally on the older side of their careers. And, you know, we're talking about what, people in their mid-30s, late-30s, maybe? And not like old people. And they were like, I can't back squat anymore. My knees kill me. My back kills me, you know. So I think that sometimes we think that the professional athlete, that's the person that we're going to really like load up and beat up and show them what's up. And really, those are the people that probably need just as much care as our 50-year-old housewife or office worker or dad, you know, and sometimes even more so because they've put their body through 20, 30 years of just beating the crap out of themselves.
Right. And even one of our coaches at our gym, Tia, playing soccer, she just tore her ACL, MCL. Oh. She had surgery last week. But she's a soccer coach for a college and she's a strength coach. So I'm like, this is kind of like great, because now you're going to be like, yeah, like I tore my ACL, MCL. Like, I know this is what the rehab process is going to be like. This is what it's going to feel like. Don't worry. Like, you're going to get back and, you know,
right.
These days, like 6 months, like 8 months.
That's crazy, for isn't ACL. It?
Yeah. It's like nothing. It's just like a, you know, quick vacation.
Right.
So I mean, just don't ever get down. Like, if you get hurt in the gym, if you're listening to this and you're a coach or a trainer, or even you're just like someone who's like really loves this stuff, use that as a learning process. Be like, all right, well, you know, how do I do ankle rehab stuff? How do I do knee rehab stuff? Like, what do I do for low back stuff? And, you know, kind of look to the people like the Gray Cooks of the world that like, yeah, like this is what you can do to get back on the field or just get back on the gym as fast as you can.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the problem that people get in this cycle is interesting. My wife read this article about the 10 things physical therapists need to know about CrossFit and CrossFitters. Mm-hmm. And the number one thing was that even if CrossFitters get hurt, their number one goal is to get back to CrossFit. And, you know, I mean, we could bash on CrossFit, but really the point of it is that a lot of us do the same thing. I've seen a lot of different individuals and coaches do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll be like, I'll be like, how did you hurt your back? Oh, I was doing heavy deadlifts. And I'd be like, okay, you know, we're going to do this, this, and this. And they'd be like, yeah, I can't wait to go back to heavy deadlifts.
Right.
I'm like,
well, it took me.
The definition is sandy there, isn't it?
it took me tearing my pec 3 times while barbell bench pressing to start barbell bench pressing, because it was just like I tore my pec. I had a partial tear on my right side. Then I got a partial tear on the left side. Then I partial tore the right side again. Like, you know what? I can dumbbell bench like up to 120s and be okay. Maybe I just don't need to go after a 300-pound bench anymore. And that's okay. Like, I can still be really strong with it, but it's just that thing. It's like, man, I used to be such a huge pain in the ass when I was working out at Cressy's and I interned there, because when Monday came around and we were benching, I was on top of the world and I just couldn't wait to get under the bar to start bench pressing. But, you know, again, at, you know, a couple of years later, that's, you know, when the pec tears came up, and like, I can let go of it. I can be okay. You don't have to do it.
All right. I mean, that's a really hard thing to do, isn't it? Like,
oh, it took me 3 times. Like, I'm a dumbass.
Third
like,
time was a charm, right?
Yeah. It's like, obviously something, I was not doing something right. You know, I just didn't have mobility or the shoulder stability. I did not have the full package to effectively barbell bench press without tearing my pec anymore, because it happened like all within 18 months, like the three tears. It's just like, Kev, your body's like not, it's telling you to not do it. And like, again, like never had a problem with dumbbell benching. It was just when I had that closed chain barbell bench press, you know, whether it was internal rotation or whatever, I don't know what was causing it. Just was not something that my pecs wanted to do anymore. And I have the golf ball size lumps on my chest, to, you know, as my medal of honor, I guess, that I at least gave it a shot.
No, I mean, I think we've all been through that process. And I think it's like you said, I mean, you have to eventually learn from you don't have to, but hopefully you learn from, you know, repeated injury or just injury in and of itself. And I think, you know, there's so much pressure in this industry, because there's, you know, a friend of mine said so well, he's like, there's a lot of sound bites in this industry. Like, you got to deadlift heavy, you got to do this, you got to do that. And it's like, not to pick on deadlifts all the time, but it's just an easy target because, you know, it seems like it cures cancer now. You know, it's like, there's other, you know, the thing we always talk about in DVRT is like, there's the movement and then there's the exercise. Like, the original thing, like, you know, you remember this functional training was train movement, not muscles. Mm-hmm. But now we're at train exercises and not movements. And I ask people, I always say, so what's the difference between a deadlift and a hip hinge? And it sounds like that horrible SAT question, right? Mom leaves at 2:30 on the train and Bob leaves at, you know, one, what time do they meet? But it's not really a true question. The answer is that deadlift is a hip hinge. A hip hinge doesn't have to be a deadlift.
Right.
And, you know, as soon as you get comfortable with that, you realize no one exercise is absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to pick the right exercise. And if you understand proper progression upon the movements, then you can choose that relatively easily.
Mm-hmm. Before we start wrapping up, we got a couple more things to talk about. But I always like to take a second to say thank you to the Patreon supporters at the show at patreon.com/thefitcast. You guys are outstanding, is what allows me to continue to do these shows. And if you become a Patreon supporter, you get some extra content. You also get the shows a week or more early. And also, you know, if you listen to the last episode with John Fass, now the proceeds of every fourth episodes go to charity. So we're able to help out the ASPCA. Thanks to those Patreon supporters, we had about $350 go to a great organization out there. And then for the month of December, the next a charity we're going to be helping out is the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. So thank you, everyone out there that is supporting the show through Patreon to help me continue to do this show. And also, at the same time, we get to help out some great organizations. So you're doing two outstanding things with, you know, your donation starting at just, you know, $1 per episode. $4 per month is how you get to become a Patreon supporter. We have some incredible superstars that do $5, $10 per episode, people that are amazing that think that this content is worth supporting. And, you know, this is a tight time of the year for people. I know holidays are coming up. So never expect anything from people that aren't in a position to help support the show. But, you know, if you do be like, yeah, you know, I can go without, you know, like Josh said, going to Starbucks this week. I don't need to go to Starbucks this week. I'll save $4. And instead, that $4 can help support four episodes of the show. And one of those dollars is going to go to charity. So you can kind of think about it, you know, that way as well. So you get to do some great stuff. So again, thank you to everyone at patreon.com/thefitcast. Some great stuff. So, whoa, just had like a... Sorry, some like car just drove by. It was like had a like huge flash of light. My scared the crap out of me. Like there was an explosion outside. Anyways, let's continue talking about, you know, what you are doing with DVRT, because I know, you know, you can get these tools. Like you can get like a kettlebell, you can get a sandbag, you can get a TRX, but like you don't really like it's kind of worthless without the education to back it up to like actually know how to make use of this stuff. So. I'm kind of just like curious, what are you guys covering in those courses and what can people expect out of them?
No, I'm glad you brought that up, and I'll try to keep this relatively brief because it's probably going to be like an hour long talk. you know, it's funny, Kevin, you know, a colleague of mine came up to me at a conference, I think it was a Perform Better conference, and tapped me on the shoulder and was like, hey, Josh, it's really cool to see what you've done with that Ultimate Sandbag stuff. I wish I had thought of it. And I'm like, yeah, I guess the ball and handle thing and the body weight on straps thing was already taken. So I had to come up with, you know, I'm being obviously a little flippant there.
Right.
But, you know, people look at, think about a traditional sandbag, a duffel bag, you know, filled with garbage bags like I did. And there's not much engineering to that. What we did is really tried to standardize the tool. Because could you imagine Olympic weightlifting if some bars were 7 feet long, some were 12, some were three, and some were 2 inches thick, some were 5 inches thick? Like, if there's no standardization to the implement, then it's really hard to program and build progression upon. So one thing we had to do was really engineer, and it's a tough piece of equipment to engineer. And people look at me kind of funny when I say that. I go, yeah, because the long bar that you put plates on was really tough to come up with, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, most people, just a little side note, don't know where the barbell came from. The barbell came from a gentleman in the early 1900s named Alan Cover. He wanted a dumbbell that he could put two hands on. That's where the innovation, the amazing innovation of a barbell came from. And I say that with sarcasm because people think, you know, all we did was put handles on a bag. And I can understand where they're coming from, but, you know, engineers actually hated our product because it's really easy to predict, you know, the stress upon a barbell because the load's always going to be displaced the same amount.
Right.
With an internal shifting load, the stress upon the structure is always going to change. Mm-hmm. And we had to think about certain things like dimension. You know, dimension is a major thing that we play with in our system because you can use it to enhance movement, challenge movement, and everything in between. And it's the only implement that has a dimensional component that you actually program. Mm-hmm. You know, with barbells, dumbbells, you don't really usually think about that. It's the same size no matter what the weight is. And so changing dimension is a big thing because we, like I said, we can use it as a way to establish good movement patterns, and we can use it as a means to challenge good movement patterns. So we not only have a load factor, but we have a dimensional factor, and dimension is also a way we can change instability. And so we cover, you know, how do we build that progressions? Not only to do how do we decide on load, the appropriate load, but how do we decide the appropriate level of instability? The reason that unstable surface training didn't work as the research has shown, is because it wasn't progressive, right? We went from staying on the ground to something that we felt like we were going to fall on our face. And that's, you know, the equivalency of, you know, let's say benching 100 pounds one set and benching 500 pounds the next set. Mm-hmm. Like, no one would think that's a good progression, but that's what we've done to instability. So what we try to really do is look at the variables of building instability in ways that has been backed by science. And a lot of that has been, you know, changing body leverage, changing load position, and changing the stability of the implement to go ahead and challenge the kinetic chains of the body. So we look at a lot of the natural sling systems. So we go over how these kinetic chains actually work, and then how do we stress them through our progressions. An easy example of that in a couple of different ways is, you know, one, you know, how many people have tried to teach, let's say, a bilateral deadlift and do a single leg deadlift? And like, we want to pull out our hair, right? It's like huge. But that's not a logical progression of body leverage. You know, that's, again, like going from a bilateral squat to a pistol. Well, there's no progression there. It's a huge jump in body position. So, you know, the analogy I give, I go, do you teach people push-ups and the next thing they're doing is plyo push-ups? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Or one-arm push-ups. Mm-hmm. So what we have is a system of how do we progress people by changing both body position and load position to progressively get them to the point, the more challenging exercises. Because what we look at is challenging exercise complexity. There was a great saying by Dr. David Frost, who's out in the University of Toronto. And he said, you know, keep the standard, change the condition. Well, what's the standard? It's the movement. How do you change the condition? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that. You know, why do people think that a single leg deadlift is not a strength exercise? Well, because they suck at it, you know, and they have so many instabilities and movement compensations that they can't produce force. Mm-hmm. But that's what we want people to be able to get to. And we have ways of progressing people and challenging them. You know, we ask people, what does instability do? And they go, it makes things hard. And really what instability does is it challenges movement accuracy. And so if you don't have high quality movement, meaning combining the elements of stability and strength together, then you can't produce good movement accuracy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's funny, like a lot of people will be like, they'll say things, for example, well, the ultimate sandbag doesn't look like a complex piece of equipment to use. I go, okay, let me give you this scenario. Let's take load out of the equation for a second. Let's just suspend load. Mm-hmm. If I have two implements, one is highly predictable and stable, it's the same every time, and one moves and shifts and no two reps are the same, which one would require more technique? Well, hopefully logic would point you to the thing that moves and shifts every time, because you're going to have to be more dialed into your technique because no two reps are the same. Mm-hmm. What throws people off is that you can win a gold medal for the stable thing and there is no sport for the unstable thing. And I think that really gets people thrown off of like, why, you mean this thing actually requires technique? And, you know, when people are really surprised, it's not teaching people to lift a sandbag better. It's teaching people to move better.
Right.
And that's the big difference. And the ultimate sandbag is a vehicle in really getting people to understand how to move better. And it's so funny because we've seen people that have been in our system for a long time. They transition and they do something like powerlift or Olympic lifting, you know, strongman, and they can do it really well. And vice versa isn't true. And that's what surprised people, because what they do is they learn how to move better. When I did strongman, because of my back, I could never really maximally outlift most of my competitors. They could generally outlift me in a maximal effort type of scenario, but I knew how to use my body more efficiently. So I could actually win some events, that maybe I shouldn't have, because they were actually theoretically quote unquote stronger than me. And so, you know, when people understand how to use proper progression in challenging, for example, plane of motion, mm-hmm. you know, like we have a whole series of how we challenge plane of motion. Most people, they do a lateral squat and thinking they're doing different planes of motion. For us, plane of motion is not changing planar dominance. It's changing the fact that we're moving in one plane and resisting forces in other planes. So how do you do that progressively? Because if you throw people in the wrong environment, they won't get the added benefit of the movement. So a lot of these things are, I think what happens to a lot of people afterwards, you know, we've had people take our courses like two or three times because it's such a different way at looking at functional training. And we spell out in such a systematic way that they're like, holy crap, I wasn't expecting that. Mm-hmm. Right. They were expecting to learn a few exercises. And so when they really learn all these, the reason they keep coming back is they're like, I got something new out of it the second time I heard it. Because sometimes we've all been in that situation, right? I've read books. I'm sure you have too. Like the time you read that book, you don't get that much out of it. You read it again at a later point. You're like, I got so much out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the same thing. If you come in with the expectation that we're going to teach you how to lift sandbags, that's not the goal at all. We're going to teach you how to move and perform better. Mm-hmm. And the progressions are set forth to teach you how to do those variables. So again, everyone's going to have a starting point and an end point, and people are going to have a path in which they can go upon. And then they now are possessing the tools to decide where upon the journey they are. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you know, I've been able to obviously check this stuff out, you know, in person when you came out to MBSC and, you know, over the last, God, five or six mm-hmm. years at the Perform Better Summits and stuff like that. Like when I'm not standing at a booth, I get to actually like peek in and check stuff out. And you know, I would totally recommend just, you know, if you go, if you're interested, like go to ultimatesandbagtraining.com and, you know, Josh and his team has more information on there and, you can check everything out. And like when I was talking about like the home gym stuff, you know, people are like, oh, what, how can I like get a home gym together and not have to spend like $5,000? Like, no, you don't need a power rack. Like you really don't. Like you can,
really don't.
You can do really well with, you know, two kettlebells and like, you know, you guys have packages on the site and I know this sounds salesy, like I don't make a penny off this stuff. So I'm just, this is me just talking. Like you can get two bags and then you can go like for $250, something like that. And then you can go down to Home Depot or wherever and get, you know, fill those things out for another $6. And you can have enough tools to have enough variability in your training to A, keep it interesting, and then B, keep it, you know, effective. And for people that don't want to have, like I sold my Airdyne, like I used to have an Airdyne. I sold it just because like, oh, well, okay. Now if I just, you know, spend 25 minutes doing some circuits with the sandbags and the kettlebells, I can keep the load low, but I can still get a great training effect in terms of just jacking up my heart rate and getting in some good training on, you know, what I would consider like my off days of training. And at the same time, when I am doing my three big full body training days, being able to change it up by implementing like the sandbags for changing up how I load things and just making things, you know, harder without, like you said, making it just heavier to make it harder.
If you don't mind, I know we're limited on time, Kevin. Just real fast, I just want to, there's actually science to what we're talking about. Like, yeah, you know, the couple of studies that I always cite is there's one comparing back squats to front squats, mm-hmm. and they looked at EMG activity in both. Mm-hmm. They found basically there was no difference in muscle activity in the lower body, but there was less shear and compression with the front squat. Not surprising,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah.
But here's the big surprise. It was they used about 30 pounds less in the front squat than the back squat. And so most people, they go, oh, front squats rule. And yeah, front squats are awesome. But the point of the matter is that load position changed the outcome of the movement and the stress. So some of the reasons that we're talking about, like, hey, you can get strong and you're not using the same weight. Well, it's not because you're just doing cardio training. It's because you're changing the application of load in a manner that challenges the body in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a study on female college volleyball players. They did a battery of lower body tests. And they found that the lunge slightly outperformed the squat. The shocking thing, it was a body weight lunge versus the loaded squat, yeah. You know, yeah. So there's, you know, information out there that's showing us that if you purely look at the load factor, then you're missing out, because why would the lunge outperform the squat? Well, we're not just, strength is not just what we lift, it's what we resist. Mm-hmm. So we can start making these leaps that like, holy crap, that makes sense. Like, you know, think about all your sporting applications, you know. How many times do people get hurt trying to resist movement than just producing it? Mm-hmm. And then finally, there was a really interesting one. They compared standing and sitting dumbbell presses and barbell presses. And they found that standing dumbbell presses activated more upper body muscles than standing barbell, even though the weight on the barbell was higher.
Mm. Yeah.
So why? The slight instability of the dumbbell.
Right.
So again, it's not like we're making this stuff up to, you know, create a cool story that, you know, that, you know, gets people going. It's the idea that there's actual science there, and we've chosen to, you know, it's called cognitive dissonance, right? Mm-hmm. We believe what we want and we take the information that we want. So, you know, what you're saying is like, you're not just getting, you know, you're not just doing training just because it's available and accessible. You're doing it because it's actually better. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really throwing people off is that a home gym and a gym for, I'll say, for business, look very similar nowadays. I think you'd agree, right?
Yeah, well, totally. I mean, we basically use our racks now. We bench once a week and we use them for chin-ups.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we use our rack for at MBSC. And like, yeah, like this is very biased, but I think we have very effective programming. We're still doing some trap bar deadlifting and stuff like that. But, you know, I can get a lot out of, doing single legged deadlifts with my 44 kg kettlebell as well. And it takes up basically zero space. Like, I have a corner of my living room that is my home gym. And I said, like, I'm not, this is no BS. Like, I'm people have been mentioning, man, dude, Kev, like, you're putting on like muscle, dude, you're looking better. Like, yeah. And it's because I'm training at home with no distractions. I train for 45 minutes or like 50 minutes, 3 days a week in the morning. And then like two other days I'll do some, like, just like I'll work on my get ups or I'll work on my swings or I'll do stuff like those reverse lunge overhead presses where it's like relatively like easy in terms of volume, but I can jack my heart rate up and I can get some effective training and movement quality out of it as well.
Yeah. I mean, and just the last point I'll make about that is, you know, it's not just a thing that you're perceiving. It's an actual real thing. There's the first study on sandbags, and we did it with the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee. And basically they took dumbbells and our ultimate sandbag, same weight, and basically had people to do the same volume of lunges. And they held them in the same position. So they held dumbbells sort of in that rack position, you know, by the shoulder. They held the sandbag on the fist. So same weight, same volume, same exercise. And they found that this ultimate sandbag has substantially higher heart rate output and energy output than the dumbbells, which is the first time we can quantitatively say a tool is not just a tool.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's the first time we can say that different tools create different outcomes. So, you know, the reason that we think that happens is because you get more compression upon the sandbag. More compression means more muscle activity, which means you end up expending more energy. So there's a reason that you're huffing and puffing when you're doing those exercises.
Well, you know, like, again, I recommend people go, you know, check them out. I mean, you can get them from Ultimate Sandbag. Excuse me. I also want to mention, but ultimatesandbagtraining.com. You guys have a shop up on there. If you're, you know, Amazon crazy, you can go on Amazon. And also, of course, our friends at Perform Better have them in stock as well. They tend to have, you know, crazy winter sales and things like that. So maybe you can grab some through there. But, you know, what, I don't know, like, you, again, you can spend $250. Like, that's not really a lot for training equipment, and, you know, have two awesome tools that you can have to add for your home gym, your personal gym. And maybe if you train at a facility, like, I used to always just bug the gym I used to train at to get a new equipment, and they would sometimes get it. So, you know, if that's something that your gym doesn't currently have, maybe go bug the fitness director or whatever and see what they can do too. So, yeah, lots of great resources on there. And of course you guys have not only certifications, but you have just great educational opportunities as well. Anything coming up, in the near future?
Well, you know, you might be a little jealous. I'm going to Japan and then Taiwan in a couple weeks.
Not bad.
And then we'll start our 2016 season pretty soon. And yeah, we have a ton of educational programs, all continuing education approved. So if you're looking for, you know, continuing education through NSCA, NASM, definitely opportunities there. And if you just want to come to the website, and we have almost 700 free YouTube videos and just, you know, update our blogs almost daily with content. So if you just want to learn more about us before you make the leap, you know, we always encourage people, like you said, to, you know, learn more about it, so that just doesn't become another tool that you just sort of sits there and you go, I don't really know what to do with that thing. The power is definitely in the education.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not too bad. I'll be back in Japan in March. So
not too bad. Probably a better time of year.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think as long as you're not there in the summer, you're going to be okay. Just don't go to Japan in the summer. It is hell on earth.
Well, you're talking about the guy that lives in Arizona, so I understand.
Sure, I guess so. I mean, it's just,
it's different, man, humidity, huh?
It is, yeah. It's brutal, but that's where we're kind of wrap things up. Now, I will remind everyone out there that you can always subscribe to the show on iTunes. If you enjoy it, I would appreciate a review on there. It's what helps keeps the show higher on those lists and make sure that some great information gets out there and we kind of get rid of some of the, you know, more mainstream, but sometimes less beneficial education stuff out there. I won't name names or trainers or, you know, people that may have their own podcasts. But I think it's always great to get better information out there. And yeah, I think that's a great introduction for all this stuff. And, you know, you can probably tell that there's still more stuff to talk about. And if you have questions for Josh, we'll definitely make sure to have him back on the show. Just you can, you know, shoot me tweets at Kevin Larrabee or at FitCast, or you can find me on, you know, both Josh and I really easily on Facebook if you want to get a hold of us, if you have any questions, things like that. And I guess that will do it. Josh, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. It's always, I mean, it's great to finally get you on and talk about some of this stuff. And we'll definitely have to catch up again down the road.
Well, I super appreciate it. And hopefully it was at least entertaining, if nothing else.
Yeah, I think we'll, you know, deliver that. And we got some great travel advice in there too. Just sorry, Travis and Carrie, if you guys are listening, I'm sorry, Japan in the summer is terrible. I mean, they know it. They leave in the summer anyways. Everyone does.
You're not working for the Japanese tourism, are you?
No, you know, I work for a gym chain there. So but that's about it. And they're, you know, perfectly air conditioned in those buildings. So I'm sure their clients and members are super happy. So, yeah, that will do it for us. We could ramble on and talk about Japan forever, but, that will do it. Thank you, as always, to everyone out there for listening and downloading and Patreon subscribers, all that stuff. We will see you next week. Take care.